about the mechanics of doing what they were doing. Suspicious of Stony Brook, suspicious of John, not challenging his character, but suspicious that they might be taken to the cleaners. And not as helpful as they might have been.
Their responsibility was not the immediate one of having to build the institution. They were a sounder move from that.
That's right. That's right. And this point deserves a comment. It is easy for folks in jobs like that to begin to think that the system that they're working with is the critical thing. And it isn't. Except insofar as it supports the creation of what is the critical thing, a first-grade university campus, one at a time. It's easy to imagine that it is the larger thing, this federation, if you will, that's important, and that has a life somehow independent of these campuses, whereas in fact it's the other way around, or ought to be seen the other way around. Now, it isn't entirely their fault that they see it that way. We can talk about that. But there is a distortion of view. All that counts in the last analysis, all that was going to count and all that did count and all that counts now, is the quality of instruction, research, public service at the campus level.
Okay.
That's the payoff.
The system doesn't do the teaching and doesn't do the research.
That's right. And it's very tough to keep that in perspective in jobs like that. Very, very tough. Even for the best academically who come into them. And why that happens is another story that we might get to. But that tension was there. The difference in perspective, John's responsibilities were clear to him. They were, and ours were clear to us. And we had a lot of trouble in making our own visions clear to the people with whom we were dealing.
How successful do you think you were?
I think we did the best we could. We mounted the best case and tried to understand, of course, what had to be done and mounted the best case for it that we knew how. We did not lack for energy or will or ability or for endurance. But we were moving very fast. And it was clear that we were working with things that had very long-range implications. On the whole, I think we did pretty well within the circumstances that surrounded us. I'm not satisfied with what has happened, but I think the team that was there, that you started and which you worked with thereafter, was a first-rate team.
Did you find support from Stevens, from Elvin Stevens, from the construction, the building?
Yes and no. He was a technically competent person. And we needed his help because we were doing an awful lot in the way of planning and building. And he wanted to do first-rate work. That's important. Yeah. He wanted to do first-rate work. but he was often difficult to deal with. Mercurial, abrasive. Tough to deal with. And he probably still is. But technically, very good. Now, there's some more questions here about my expectations, but I'd like to follow any questions that you may have that might bear directly upon the central question. It asks here about whether my activities were confined to the Stony Brook campus. Yes, although I was working with those who were right in touch. Alec and John, of course, were always working the countryside and working Albany, and I was back and forth with them a good deal, and had a pretty clear idea of those relationships and how they worked well and how they worked badly. So I was there, but I was not a principal. I was a staff figure.
Joe Diana was there when you were there.
Joe Diana came after I was there. He came from the University of Michigan, I believe. Brought some real talent there, and he came into an area of great difficulty, which he tried to repair, and I'd say that only went indifferently well, for a variety of reasons.
Remember Cliff Decker in Maine?
Yes, I do. I had a good impression of him. I think he left eventually, and I think it was not altogether a happy separation.
No, it wasn't. And he attributed to Joe Diana being instructed to try to get something on John Cole.
Well, there was a funny relationship there between Joe Diana and Kepler.
Back up to the central office.
In central, and John. I don't attribute mischievous motives to anybody there, but it was not a healthy arrangement. And the reason, I think, that it wasn't structurally was that Kepler was concerned about the management of financial affairs at Stony Brook, because things were moving very rapidly, and the system was, financial system was changing underhand, and new kinds of talents were required. Some of the staff that had been brought forward from the old days were good people, but to some degree technicians and not senior managers. And what was required was changing from good technicians to senior managers, so there were problems there. Joe Diana, I'll tell you a story about that, too. Joe Diana came in. John actually had tried to put me into that financial vice presidency. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I had been running the budget for some time, and I would have been interested in doing it, but Kettler stopped him on that, and I think that's where Diana came into the picture. I think that's right. In any event, John sensed that something more was required in the area of financial management, and had in mind putting me into that, and did try to do it. Was stopped by Kettler because I had no experience having done that somewhere else. I imagine that's why. And then when he began to assert himself, when Kepler did, the assertion took the form of having a very heavy hand in the placement of the new man, who was Diana. And it was my impression that after Joe Diana came, he maintained a connection with Kepler that produced a divided reporting responsibility. In effect, it was a poisonous design, and it had poisonous consequences. Yes, I remember Joe Diana.
Did Boyer come in? before you left. You left the question what year?
I left in 1971.
71.
Mm-hmm. To go to Michigan. And yes, Boyer had arrived on the scene, and I had seen him at work a few times in Auburn. I don't recall his being on campus, although I suppose he was, but I did see him at work in Auburn. But he must have come on just before I sold out. It must have been late 60s or maybe...
Why did you leave?
Oh, it was, I wanted to leave. I felt it was time to go. I simply wanted to do more. That is, I wanted additional responsibility of some kind. I wasn't really too concerned about what kind it was, maybe in the area of the financial management of the campus. That would have suited me. When Kettler put that stop on things, and I saw John's hand checked in that way, I pretty well concluded that I had reached the limit of what I was going to do there. Though I did stay on for a while after that, but professionally it was just time to do something else. And then, of course, the opportunity to be the chancellor out at the University of Michigan, that came out of the blue, and it was something probably that would have drawn me anyway, but I concluded after Kettler seemed to be exercising that control, and I thought John's autonomy, his freedom to move, was badly checked at that point. And while I had a better impression than ever of John, and Alec, I still admire those two persons unqualifiedly, I thought the time had come to break away. And soon thereafter, the opportunity came, and I left.
Okay. Did you have any feel for the quality of the faculty or the quality of the students?
Yes. I thought the faculty were better than the students, although the students were getting good. They were fairly good while I was there and beginning to get very good. The faculty leadership, the ones that were being brought in and put into the departmental chairmanship, the distinguished professorships and so on, were being filled by remarkably able people. But, and it's not a very serious but, they were tough people to live with. Prima donnas, impatient with the crudeness of Stony Brook, and it was crude. Facilities, its operating procedures. It was pretty raucous and wild place. And so the people coming in were very high quality, I thought, academically. But they didn't fit together all that well. They were not awfully tolerant of one another and certainly not very tolerant of the administration. The faculty administrative connections there were pretty rough, I thought. And all of that roughness was amplified and aggravated by the Vietnam problem and these failures of governance understanding to which I alluded earlier. So there were all kinds of things whirling around in there that made relationships between faculty and faculty, between faculty and administration, and between faculty and administration and students, rough. And it was rough.
Remember the drug bust?
I do. It was a very destructive development that the campus didn't recover from for a long time. It damaged John's leadership there because it was done without his knowing about it. It frightened the campus in that it suggested external powers were hostile to the campus and to its development, which wasn't altogether inaccurate. That is, the community was still at odds with the university, and this raid
Well, not all of the community.
Oh, of course not. But this raid that took place, the way in which that was done, I thought reflected an infection in the community, a degree of puzzlement and concern, some degree of hostility to the emergence of this giant in their midst. And, you know, there were a lot of ways that the arresting of people involved with drugs could have been handled. The melodrama of that thing was gratuitous.
Did you see the program? Half a thick program with the face of a knight on horseback that was handed out to the TV and newspaper people?
No.
It was a production.
Yeah.
I think part of it stems from the need of the Republicans to recoup themselves over a scandal, I think the Seward assistant scandal. In other words, it was not simply the university. It was internally as a Republican Party.
There were probably a whole lot of things going on there, and this community grumpiness about some of the developments at Stony Brook was, I'm sure, only one strain in the whole thing. And I don't pretend to understand all that's going on there, but I do know that the arrival of 50 or 80 police cars and all of that marching about and the collecting of people in the middle of the night, people who could easily have been simply mailed an indictment, a subpoena. That was gratuitous, it was crude, and hurt.
It did a lot to damage the image, the public image of the university for a while.
Yeah.
And by contrast, it was news because of the favorable publicity that Stony Brook had had prior to that time.
Yes, I don't know who was responsible for that, but that came at a critical time and it hurt. Of course, to some degree, the factors that were present on campus were hurting the university too. That is the Vietnam ferment and the stress there between components of the university, because the place hadn't settled down yet and it was changing so rapidly. The institution was very vulnerable, and it took a lot of hits of different kinds, and that one was just the most melodramatic. But, you know, we were quite regularly in the New York Times, and some of it was favorable, but there was a kind of a lust in the media, I think, for problems, and we had them.
Well, there's an aspect of the media which is almost feminine. It's the ain't it awful spirit.
Yeah, finger wagging, yeah. We just had an experience like that down here. We've made a decision to go into Division I athletics, and there was an editorial in the Raleigh News and Observer, sort of finger wagging, nothing original, you know, nothing penetrating. That's what you're talking about. The wringing of hands at a world that will not do what the editors think should be done. And Stony Brook was getting there, I guess, too. It's an old story.
Well, we come to the end of the question.
I think everything in here we have spoken to. We didn't take these things in the precise order, but we've really covered them all, I think.
All right.
Unless there are any other things that you want to touch upon, Carl.
No, I think you have handled the internal operations, programming, getting capital equipment into the pipeline. The relativism within the system, you and I spoke about that, but maybe you didn't speak for the record here. And the upstate view of Long Island, it seems to be, as if people up there put on a certain set of glasses and look at Long Island.
It's not unusual, you know, in the state of Michigan, Wayne State University, in around Detroit, very important university, has very little sympathy from the legislature that comes from the middle and central part of Michigan. It's much like that. It's very tough to get a legislator, a powerful legislator who comes from another part of the state, to look fondly on this thing that's eating up money and seems to him a long way from home. In fact, it isn't. That is his, very often, you know, he has more interest. Senator Anderson had more of an interest in Stony Brook perhaps than he understood, because wherever he came from, I don't remember where it was, his children from that area were going to depend upon Stony Brook in some important ways. But I don't think they see that too clearly, some kind of. You haven't asked about what we were talking about earlier, how it has turned out.
All right.
Let's talk about that for a minute.
All right.
Because we spoke about the ambitions and the quality of the people that were there and the resources and so on. I haven't a lot to say about how it turned out because I'm not there, and I left in 71. That's 15 or 16 years ago.
That's about the end of the period that I'm supposed to be collecting data.
Oh, okay. That's right. Well, let me just say that I'm not satisfied with how it has turned out, though what has been accomplished at Stony Brook is not trivial, but I think its best days are still ahead. They haven't been reached yet.
But thanks very much.
Well, it's a pleasure. A pleasure, Carl.
You supplement very well some of the other interviews.
Yes, you know, you're going to have a very interesting portrait of this thing.
Right.
You're going to know more about this than with these tapes, if you're the only one that's heard them. Than anyone in the world about what really happened there.
When the four of us were, or five of us were talking at my home to begin with, they were reminiscing very rapidly about Oyster Bay.
Which four or five are speaking of?
Sidney Gilbert, chairman of the Department of Philosophy and former dean.
Yeah.
Francis Bonner, chairman of the Department of Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Irvine, dean of engineering, former dean of engineering. Cliff Schwartz, one of the first people in physics. And Francis's comment when we were clearly talking about Oyster Bay, he said, you know, if anybody were to write a story of Oyster Bay, nobody'd believe it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so many types of conflicts, so many different kinds of people, so many jealousies, so many conflicts in philosophy of education, Chicago versus the Columbia group. bringing in, to start it, a dean as dean, somebody who didn't have his PhD, who was a philosopher, winding up with a president who was an engineer. And philosophers and engineers are poles apart in their thinking. A divisional concept from Chicago, departmental concept from Raleigh, North Carolina. The elements of conflict were there.
Yeah. Well,
and I came in when the faculty was split. The students were anti-administration.
Bitterly so, or just sullenly so?
Oh, I don't know. I was a new face, I think, that helped.
Yeah.
And I had 10 years.